Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Regina Barzilai, professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT and a recipient of the 2017 MacArthur Fellowship Award, about her plan to use artificial intelligence to spot deadly cancers sooner. This is an amazingly important topic. I'm sure all of our listeners, as well as my colleagues, are really interested in understanding better about artificial intelligence and then how one can apply it to problem solving. But first, let's dive right in to a little bit of research that matters. This is really diverse research that I think we find exciting at the Department of Family Medicine. Hope you do as well. Our first one is about botulism toxin. We know that botulism toxin has been around for a long time, and it's used for a whole variety of conditions. Most frequently, people hear about it for dealing with wrinkles to help smooth out those lines injected. It's used in a lot of cosmetic dermatology practices. It's also used to help out people who have severe sweating problems into the axilla and helping dry those up. It's used for people. I have some patients that have dystonia of their cervical muscles and really spasm, and it helps relieve those. And so it should be no surprise then when we think about its use to help reduce chronic migraine attacks. I've had a few migraines in my life, and I know how painful that can be with the nausea and the severe headaches and the lights bothering. And you really, you know, you can take these anti-inflammatory medications. Sometimes you have to take these triptans, these kind of drugs that can abort it. And here there's this botulinum toxin. And in the Journal of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, authors in France did what's called a systematic review. We've talked about this on Your Health before, but it's these compilation of studies. And this, they looked at data from 17 previous randomized controlled trials looking at the botulinum toxin compared to placebo, nothing active, for preventive treatment of headaches. And this was involving 17 studies with nearly 3,600 patients, 1,500 who had chronic migraine, 15 migraine attacks per month for more than 3 months. That's a lot of migraines. And they had, so at least 8 days per month. And then some of the patients had less frequent migraine attacks. And there's been some conflicting evidence, some studies really showing this, and it is FDA, Food and Drug Administration approved. But in this particular study, they actually, as they could combine it all together, had enough statistical power, enough possibilities with all the patients together to really see that 3 months after injection, these toxin injections significantly reduce the frequency of chronic migraine attacks. Those who had been injected had an average of 1.6 fewer migraine attacks per month compared to those who had the placebo. Now, if you had 15 headache attacks a month and you're now down to just over 13, you might say, is that a lot of migraine attacks? And I think that's a reasonable question. On the other hand, if you're the migraine person having the migraine attacks, you might say, hey, it's me that's getting the improvement. And that may also mean that a bunch of people get more relief. Some people may get no relief. So you may actually get a significantly dramatic relief. And so this is actually something interesting. Also, those who had episodic migraine tended to have less attacks. And they even found in this systematic review that there was a significant improvement in the quality of life of those patients who were treated with this injection, linked to reduction in depressive symptoms. So again, this gets us to the belief that these things are probably important and it should be in the armamentarium. I guess one of the questions would be, you know, what about side effects? At least that's what I would ask. This toxin can cause a urinary tract infection. It can cause some difficulty, depending on where it's injected. You might have some difficulty swallowing. So I think you have to really ask your physician if you have chronic migraines about, is this right for you? But certainly, I think it's something worth talking about. Hopefully, this describes some of those impacts better. Speaking of talking about, this next research that matters is about what we're not talking about, and that's talking about the online medical portals. These are the portals, we call them patient portals, where we doctors can send our patients and our patients can send to we doctors information that they want to ask. So it would be very typical. I saw patients this morning, and I've got lots of lab results for lots of patients. In the past, I'd have to have my nurse, or I would have to call my patient. Now I can send portals. So I always ask when the patient leaves, are you on our medical portal? If they say yes, it's great. I'd like to send you, because you can get the results of your lab test an hour ago, maybe an hour from now. Is that cool or what? However, if patients aren't using these portals, that then becomes a problem. And this is what this research, which was published in the journal Health Affairs, and they did a national survey of patients in the United States, and they found that 2/3 of insured participants, these are people who have health insurance, so they probably presumably have better access, maybe even better resources, but they had not used an online medical portal in the last year. And there was real disparities, those who were less likely to have it compared to those who were more likely to have it. This was among over 2,000 insured patients, and 63% had not used this patient portal. Those who were less likely to use it were men. Those are older than age 65. Those were unemployed if you lived in a rural area, if you were on Medicaid, and if you had less education or less access to a regular doctor. Now, there could be lots of reasons for why there's this disparity, but the simple fact is we can do better. I think all of us need to say, how can we communicate? Because I can tell you, it's not just me communicating with you. It's when you have questions, you can get directly. And I'm checking this patient portal several times a day. And we can talk about quickly back and forth at times when we can answer it rather than waiting and seeing when the telephone is convenient for all of us. So I think this has a greater role. I think this is going to be more research we need to do. The next research that matters is about fiber. Not fiber in our adult listeners, but fiber in our adult listeners' children. And I can tell you, from having had 3 children myself, it's not so easy for kids to get fiber because they don't like to eat the fruits and vegetables and beans. But I can tell you also, constipation is a big problem, and not just in adults, but also in kids. And the things like hemorrhoids and other issues and pain are really frequent increasingly because we don't get enough fiber. And this was research that really looked at this whole issue of fiber, and it was in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it really found that teens in the study were getting only 1/3 of the recommended fiber they should get a day. And so most teens and adults should be getting about 30 grams of fiber a day, and the kids were getting 10 grams. So this is a big issue. We really can be talking about and teaching our children about fiber because it improves not only gut transit, it improves insulin receptivity, it lowers blood pressure, and it lowers blood sugar. All these things are good to reduce the burden of diabetes that can really inflict, and high blood pressure that can inflict so many. Last research that matters has to do with something that's near and dear to me, which is pain in the neck. Now, I'm not a pain in the neck. Some people could disagree, but the pain that one gets from sitting in front of a computer day in, day out, scrunching your shoulders up, and you don't even realize you're doing it, and then you get this chronic pain. And this was really an interesting research in a journal called Biofeedback, where researchers had 88 students kind of sitting in front of the computer properly aligned and then turning their heads, and then they had to scrunch their necks. And then what was happening is they could turn their heads so much further when they weren't scrunching. And then they found out that when they were scrunching, these students developed some level of pain, even just for 30 seconds. And I think this is so important because people develop headaches, as we talked about with our migraines before. And a lot of it can come from just bad posture, bad use of your muscles, and you don't even know it. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. When we return, we're going to hear a conversation with Dr. Regina Barzilai, professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT and a recipient of the 2017 MacArthur Fellowship Award, about her plan to use artificial intelligence to spot deadly cancer sooner. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Regina Barzilai, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT and recipient of the 2017 MacArthur Fellowship Award, about her plan to use artificial intelligence to spot deadly cancers sooner. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Barzilai.
Hello.
It's great to have you on Your Health today to talk about something I think is really important. What's happening in the world of research and artificial intelligence? But before we begin, how about you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get interested in a career in research? Because I think it's probably not what people might expect.
So my original background is in natural language processing and machine learning. So I've been doing AI at MIT since 2003 when I started here as an assistant professor. And I really stay far from medicine because there are so many fascinating problems in all other areas of AI, and I kind of worked in whatever was of direct interest to me. And I think 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was the first time when I was a patient, like real patient. And it came as a huge surprise to me personally because nobody in my family ever had cancer. But it also, what was even more surprising was at some point you get the idea that, you know, you have this disease and you need to go through the treatment, is how very little AI we have in healthcare. And I was treated in one of the best hospitals in the country, in Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm very happy with their treatment. But and every single opportunity of my treatment, I saw we could use AI here to deliver faster results, more accurate results, and to give more information both to the patient and to the provider. And unfortunately, none of these technologies that we are developing at MIT and people are developing in other AI centers were in the clinic. So when I finished my treatment and, you know, I came back to my research group at MIT, I decided that, you know, as a personal mission to change the situation.
You know, that's really interesting. Just for our listeners, when you say AI, we mean artificial intelligence. And describe, if you would, for kind of 101 for that freshman college student, how do you describe artificial intelligence, you know, in 30 seconds or less?
Okay. So artificial intelligence is the ability of machine to make predictions based on their past experiences. So for instance, when, you know, your iPhone can recognize your face or some other, you know, image, this machine was trained by giving to it lots and lots of images where machine knows that this is a cat, this is a dog, and this is a flower. So next time when it sees an object, it should be able to kind of translate the low-level patterns into a particular label. And the algorithm that enable machines to do this kind of learning developed within the artificial intelligence research.
So when we think about the difference between, let's say, epidemiology, the study of diseases and populations where you gather tons of data and then make predictions, and there can be other fields outside of public health or medicine. What's the difference between AI and these large data sets?
So in some ways, what this technology, this new technology does, it takes the methods which were always there, always in medicine, always in public health, of learning from, you know, big data sets and just making them much more robust and powerful and able to deal with a lot of information. So in medicine, I was actually reading this book, Emperor of All Maladies, about cancer. I was really surprised how much discoveries were done, you know, in the last century, even in 19th century, just based on the data. Even before people understood biology, they kind of could predict what will happen just based on the frequency of the pattern. So what happened in the artificial intelligence community with the development of deep neural networks and much stronger algorithms, we can do much better predictions. And just to illustrate to you how it changes our analysis, let's think about like an area like reading images and predicting risk. Like previously, when we have human in the loop, we need to identify the pattern and say, if the patient have this type of pattern on their imaging, maybe it means that they have increased risk. So it means that the human needs to identify the patterns, teach other humans, and get connected to the risk. And there is a lot of information that is lost in this process of abstraction. On the other hand, you can just give to machine millions of images where you know the outcomes and let machine directly translate these patterns into insights.
So when we're talking about risk, and in the patient encounter, I'm always talking about risk. I can talk about the absolute risk. Your risk goes from 1% to 2%, but I could say that's also a relative risk of 100%, and so we can influence how people perceive that risk. Can artificial intelligence also help us understand different ways of what our own risk might be?
I think absolutely that artificial intelligence is exactly what it does. And if you are following, what is described in the literature, today in the newspapers, when today, the risk of giving a loan to somebody in a bank is computed with artificial intelligence, or if somebody recommends you a product on the Amazon, it's again assessment how likely is it you're going to like certain product. So this is a prime area for artificial intelligence in to make this kind of strong prediction, getting more and more data. Because in majority of areas of medicine, the risk models are really, really antiquated in the sense that they can use just limited number of factors that were identified by humans. That every imaging information that is used is always first translated into humans into some limited number of categories. The prediction models that you are getting in many cases are really weak. So the problem is not how to convey it to a patient, but the error bars many times are so high that you cannot really act upon this information.
How in the kind of, again, the interaction between a patient and a provider, do you see this translation of artificial intelligence occurring? Because I know from my experience that the data that I get describes what's happening in a population and can be applied. Can we develop it as an individual level so I can say what your particular risk? Is that what artificial intelligence is promising?
Absolutely. That's actually what we developed in the breast cancer area when the model looks at, the specific image of the breast of a patient and gives to this patient a risk of her getting breast cancer within 2 or 5 years. So it really looks at your tissue, which is not like anybody else, and then predicts you individualized risk. And this is a big difference from the standard models that are currently in clinical practice, which are actually working at the population level, but are very weak on the personalized level. And besides very few specific cases, like BRCA cases, in most cases, they cannot really give us strong answers.
So if we think about one of the common cancers for men, most common cancer, prostate cancer, one of the real dilemmas right now is whether or not to screen men with a prostate-specific antigen, the PSA test, because does it provide any benefit? How then does artificial intelligence promise to help us in a situation where we don't know if the screening test actually provides benefits or not? Can it help us with that answer?
Absolutely. The problem is that now when we're doing the screening and somebody has increased levels, some of these patients are going to be perfectly fine without interventions, and some of these patients really are going to likely to develop aggressive cancer, and they need something special. So what I believe a strong prediction model can do, it can really disentangle these two group of patients and say that not only looking at this one measurement, maybe looking at other measurements, can tell that this patient is fine, we don't need at this point to intervene, and these patients really need to have some very specialized treatment. So our ability to predict the future better would definitely result in early detection and better treatment plan on one hand, and on the other hand will eliminate a lot of over-treatment that currently lots of patients are getting.
This is really fascinating. We're going to take a short break, though. When we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Regina Barzilai, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT and recipient of the 2017 MacArthur Fellowship Award about using artificial intelligence to spot deadly cancers sooner. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Regina Barzilai, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, about her research to use artificial intelligence to spot deadly cancers sooner. And right before the break, Dr. Barzilai, you talked about how with something like, you know, elevated PSA levels, you could kind of subdivide to those who might be at high risk or low risk to better understand who might need a biopsy. It would not, however, tell us that even with those who are biopsied who develop cancer, that those cancers would be the ones that would be likely to be manifest in their life? Or could it? Because that seems to be a kind of a critical issue. Is the technology itself useful?
So to me, the question is like, it depends how do you train the machine. If you train the machine and you really collect all the information about the patients and you know what happened to them within certain time frame, like let's say within 5 years, you would know some of them really went and developed very aggressive disease, some of them didn't. And then you are given, assuming the machine has enough access to information that it's maybe not only this blood test, but maybe some other information, if there is enough correlation, machine should be able to figure it out. And if it doesn't, there are two possibilities. Either, again, there is not enough information and more needs to be collected, maybe some additional genetic information and so on, or the algorithm is not strong enough, and we are making a lot of progress to make the algorithm strong. So I think that this is really a power of these technologies, that instead of looking just on one source of information and looking at one clue, you can take lots and lots of clues, and some of them may be very weak clues, and you can aggregate it and give you a stronger prediction.
What is the current thinking of the risk of AI? And by that I mean, when we think about screening tests, we think about lung cancer screening or even mammography, we know that there are risks, psychological risk, physical risk, intervention risk, taking out cancers that never been manifest. For artificial intelligence, how do you think about what are the risks of that technology?
So I think like every type of technology, it comes, you know, with benefits, but it also has some limitations. And one interesting question is how does this technology will be actually living in the clinic? Do you let this technology decide instead of the doctor? Do you use technology to kind of expand capacity of the doctor, provide an extra pair of eyes? Which information do you convey to the patients? What do you convey even to the insurance? Let's say if a patient, now the algorithm predicts that the patient has increased risk of breast cancer in the next 2 years, does it mean that now they have pre-existing condition or the insurance actually provides them treatment which may prevent the cancer from occurring? So there are lots and lots of questions around how to intelligently integrate this technology in the clinical care. And I think what on the technology side we have demonstrated that, you know, this technology is doing really useful and interesting things. What we really haven't seen in scale so far, that the medical establishment knows how to take advantage of this technology in a productive way.
So we could, for instance, if someone through AI and their mammogram, you showed that they were at increased risk, but they happen to also be obese, which is a major epigenetic changer of risk for breast cancer, we could really hone in on weight loss as trying to cut down on that risk, as one example.
Yeah, this is one example. Like, for instance, today in Massachusetts, you cannot get a mammogram every year unless you are high risk, but the models which determine who is high risk are so inaccurate. So imagine that, you know, the woman does her first mammogram at age 40, and then the machine predicts that, and we actually can do it today, is to say that the risk of this woman to get cancer in the next 2 years is extremely low, so there is no reason for her to be screened so often. For some, it would say that she should be screened every year, and for some, it would say the risk is so extremely high that she should be screened with MRI, and maybe other intervention should be done to decrease her chance of cancer. And today when we are thinking about medicine, we are thinking about giving it when the patient is already sick. But if we have very strong models that can tell us what's to come, maybe we can shift the use of medicine. There are quite a number of medications that are already on the market, like chemo prevention. You can think using them much more aggressively if we trust more these artificial intelligence models.
So as we think about moving from the lab to the clinic, tell us where your research is, because I know and you received the MacArthur Award. This is a select group of people at MIT. You have more than your share. That really signifies your research, your ideas really are having impacts. How is that translating right now?
So first of all, I got my massage or on my working natural language processing on doing useless tasks like translating ancient Semitic language Ugaritic, which is a dead language, into Hebrew.
And but that's not, things, there are some people.
Just fun to do. But I actually, when I came to do research in medicine, I really wanted to see the impact. I was not just interested to publish it and, you know, let somebody else do implementation. I was very lucky to collaborate with the head of breast imaging at Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Connie Lehman. And we started, once we developed the algorithm and tested them extensively, we actually started implementing them in clinics. So last January, we implemented an algorithm which already read, you know, thousands of mammograms, which reads and assesses automatically breast density, which is one of the risk factors for breast cancer. It has to be reported to the patient. And one of the challenges is that human radiologists are very inconsistent in it, and even the same radiologists apparently may give different numbers, looking at the same mammogram within, you know, with some difference in reading, difference in time. Like this month you read one number, in 2 months you read another number. So, and it been working, you know, the whole practice at MGH Boston and in their satellite clinic adapted it. And human has extremely high rate of agreement with the machine, and it improved human consistency, which is actually very important. And now we are putting our risk model in production. Given, again, the mammogram, we will compute how likely the woman is, you know, if she is at risk of breast cancer or if she has very low risk. And our clinical collaborators at MGH in the internal medicine and others are kind of developing a pipeline how the patient should be handled depending of what prediction the model makes, and actually help to eliminate unnecessary screening and procedures on one hand, and on the other hand, patients who really need them, to give them priority in getting those special treatments.
You know, this sounds really, really fascinating, because we know that facts plus how you react to those facts, the emotions, really reacts to decisions. And I imagine this AI can really give us the factual basis. Can it deal with the emotional basis, those intangible elements?
I think that, you know, whenever you are a patient, and I so much remember myself as a patient, the things that I was suffering through, and it's not only because I'm an MIT professor who is like crazy about numbers, but I remember talking to many other patients, and you really feel you don't have information. Often you ask a question, and the answer would be there was a clinical trial, but it wasn't taken in this part of the country, and it was 10 years ago, and the things changed, and you really don't have information. Still remember, I got MRI, and it was false positive. For 2 weeks, I saw that I have cancer all over, and then it was false positive. I had to do extra biopsies. You know, I was just imagining going through it, that machine reads it, and machine, you know, eliminates all this extra anxiety that I went through. And I think as we are using this technology more broadly, we can just make people to be more informed and less anxious and feel more in control of their treatment and their decisions.
More informed, less anxious, more in control of their own decisions. That's pretty lovely.
That's what I'm thinking about. But again, you need to have a doctor who can explain it to you in a way which will make you comfortable with whatever choices you are making.
So it sounds like we still need the doctor. We can't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Absolutely. It's just a helper. It's doctor's helper. It's not a substitute for the doctor.
Well, we really want to thank you for helping us understand artificial intelligence, its expanding role in cancer, chronic disease. And I guess we're grateful that your research in languages that you described as dying, but certainly of coming back to life and having a different life. And I think you can help all of us with this type of research that you're doing. So thank you so much for being your guest on Your Health.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Regina Barzilai, professor of electrical injury and computer science at MIT, about her research on artificial intelligence and cancer. We're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If we have an issue that you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send any comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura, what do we have?
The first listener asks, I am getting older and I have really no family. I do have some close friends, and they've encouraged me to have my power of attorney documents done, as I also have several medical conditions. What's the difference between a healthcare power of attorney and a power of attorney document? And who do you think I should appoint if I'm unable to make those decisions?
What an important question.
Big question.
It's a big question. We could probably do a couple shows on this, because this also is about advanced directives. It's a conversation that we need to have with patients and doctors as we get older and we have health conditions. And we're starting to wonder what would happen to us if we were incapacitated. Now, it could happen at a young age. So anything can happen anytime. And so, but as we get older, it's more likely things are happening with your health. So We know about the advanced directives. The power of attorney, we don't think about as much in the healthcare power of attorney. But we should think about if you've got a document that describes if you had cancer and you were not responding, would you still want to be treated if you had a severe pneumonia? Would you want to, if you had to go on a respirator, would you want to go on a respirator even though knowing that your cancer is incurable? What if you had a severe stroke? Would you want a feeding tube put in if you couldn't swallow and yet you weren't conscious? What if you had heart failure and it was so bad that your life expectancy was 3 months? Would you have resuscitation done and CPR done? Well, these are the kinds of decisions. Do you want IV fluids? Do you want antibiotics done when you're really sick? Now, if you're young and healthy and you get the flu, you probably go full court, right?
Right,
you would
yeah.
want to be on a respirator. You'd want everything done because you could return to a good quality of life.
Theoretically, your outcomes could be pretty good.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you get to make those choices.
Right.
I'm not making them for you. And so your decision-making in as many circumstances we can come up with, and every state has these power of attorney documents. You go to the AARP, and they can see your state and have these documents, and you can get them notarized. And you can say, you know, who you want to make those decisions. Now, if you have a family member, it would be more straightforward, unless you have, like, in my case, three children, and do you want to appoint all of them to do it jointly, or do you say, I'm going to have one of them do it? Because if you have all three do it, what happens if they disagree? Two people say, you know, we'd like to have an IV fluid given and antibiotics, and the other says, no, I don't want that done. So you could have these disagreements there. But you've got to appoint someone. Think about who is maybe the closest to you who would know your wishes. And then the thing is, in this case, what about the person who doesn't have a family member, right? They don't really have that family member. So then it's a question of a close friend. And you really have to understand this close friend. Now, they have to do what you've asked them to do. They can't, like, make independent decisions.
Right.
So the more they do that, and then tell your doctor as well, because the doctor is going to be the one that maybe has to know when to invoke that, that maybe you have advanced dementia and you can no longer make that decision. The doctor will say, ah, this person can't make it, and then you can ask that healthcare power of attorney. Lastly, The power of attorney isn't about really healthcare. It's about everything else. So it's about your legal situation, your property, your bank account,
kind of stuff.
All of those things that may be left undecided about who can make those decisions. But they're great documents to have. I encourage everyone to have them at really any age.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I weigh just over 300 pounds, and I seem to be gaining about 5 pounds a year for the last 20 years. I've never been small, but now I really am too heavy. My doctor has recommended many interventions, and the last time I was there, she said that she was worried that if I didn't have bariatric surgery, my diabetes and blood pressure were going to get out of control. How true do you think this is?
Well, you know, this is such an important issue because we think about, you know, weight loss and weight gain as this dramatic thing. You know, let's take this diet and we're going to lose, you know, 50 pounds and we can do it really quickly. Well, no, that doesn't really happen
right.
That way. It happens and it doesn't come on that way usually. So people don't gain weight. Here in this particular case, this person's gaining about a pound every 10 weeks.
Very slowly.
Very
slow.
Slowly. Yeah. That's right. And 1 pound of weight gain is really only 3,500 extra calories in than out.
Wow.
So the reality is that's over 10 weeks. That's 350 calories per week more than
that's
you need.
Not much.
After 10 weeks would be a pound. 350 calories, that's
a really good donut.
That's a really good donut or 2 pieces of toast or
yeah.
a bagel or
yeah.
something like that. Yeah. So it's not very much.
No.
That causes it. The good news is that the weight loss can occur with something similar. You could take off 5 pounds a year. You could take off 10 pounds a year just by increasing the amount of calories that you don't have in compared to what's going out. Now, in this particular case, how likely is that to occur? I don't know, but I wonder if this patient's actually been working with the provider and has worked on weight loss issues with standard behavioral therapies mm-hmm. for decades, weeks, months, unsuccessfully. Turns out bariatric surgery is the most likely thing that's going to have this person really quit. What I'd strongly encourage is to meet with a program that does intensive behavioral medical therapy that also can add bariatric therapy if it doesn't work. So if you've gone through 6 months of that type of program, you're not getting results, I think a consultation would be in order. It could lower the blood pressure. It could lower the cholesterol. It could be life-saving in ways preventing and or curing diabetes.
Am I assuming correctly that a program like that would also have supports in place after bariatric surgery, should it take place, to help maintain a healthy response to that kind of surgery?
Yeah, and you know, people are worried about the side effects, but we should think about the side effects of the obesity itself,
right. yeah.
cancer, heart disease, arthritis, disability. And yes, there are good resources available in almost all these programs that are doing surgery to ensure that the side effects can be minimized and the quality of life can be great.
Great.
What's our very last house call?
I'm 22 years old, and I've been on depot shots for the last 6 months. However, I've had constant bleeding as well. While the shots are convenient, the bleeding is not. What do you think my best birth control option might be that's convenient like the shots but without these side effects?
We actually should probably do a whole show just on this question alone because there's lots of factors that go into this. One is the cost. It turns out that almost all the birth control solutions have about the same cost. What you can spend over 5 years is about the same, and it's hundreds of dollars a year of outlay. And then you think about the ease. So a shot that you get every 3 months is easier than taking a pill every single day. You can get injectable hormones that can last mm-hmm. for years, and so that actually may be the easiest one.
Even more convenient, yeah.
But the problem is then you have side effects. So side effects being bleeding. Well, those injectable hormones may cause the same amount of bleeding. An IUD, an intrauterine device, which can last years, can be implanted. You don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You could still have the bleeding problem. The birth control pills you got to take every single day. So, you know, how easy is that? And
yeah.
you have to remember it. And then in terms of other types of side effects there, you know, things that would be less problematic might be things like a cervical guard, a cervical cap, and things that you can put intrauterine, a diaphragm there. You may have to combine these with other forms of birth control to like a male wearing a condom to prevent sexually transmitted diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So I would talk with your doctor. There are some great resources that Planned Parenthood and other provider groups put out
right.
about effective birth control.
Great.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. If you have anything you want to share with us, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, and our guest today, Dr. Regina Barzilai. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.